Well, we have been following the life of Elisha ever since Elijah cast his mantle upon him. When Elisha has proven himself to be a good and faithful servant. I want to just pause there for a moment. Because we just read of Elisha's servant Gehazi, who in the mundane, menial tasks proved himself to be a pagan. Elisha, on the other hand, was there to wash the feet of Elijah, was there to wash the prophet's hands, and he proved himself to be faithful in no small things. And the Lord has continued to use Elisha, but in the case of Gehazi, Gehazi is put to the side. He's an unfaithful, ungodly servant. We're looking here again this morning at this man, Elisha. But as you read down through that text, you will notice that actually Elisha takes only up a few verses. We have four characters here. We have the little girl. We have the mighty Naaman. We have Elisha. And we have Gehazi. And so I thought the only way to really treat this whole chapter is to look at all four of those characters, but there's one clear theme throughout here. It's this. It's very simply the sovereignty of God. It's very clear from this passage, chapter 5, even from the opening verses, that there is a God who's in control of absolutely everything. That's why we sang that psalm, to trust in the Lord. David trusted in God, for he knew that God was sovereign. And so we want to look at this passage with that being our main title, the sovereignty of Elisha's God. First of all, I want you to see the child of faith. The child of faith. If you go with me here to verse 2. Verse 1 is spoken about Naaman, who he was, and so on and so forth. But in Naaman's house, verse 2, we see this little child. Verse 2, and the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, just a little maid. And she waited on Naaman's wife. Here's a little girl. Now, I spoke about her before, and therefore I don't want to focus the whole sermon on her, but she's very, very easy to preach on and very beautiful to preach on. She is really a little diamond in the middle of this whole passage. It's been said before, if this little girl wasn't a bright and shining light for God, 2 Kings chapter 5 wouldn't exist. There would be nothing to tell. Were it not for this little girl, who, like Elisha, was given some responsibility as a servant to wash her master's feet, to tend to the things around the house. But even there with those menial tasks, she served her God well. She was bright and fervent for her master. But I want you to enter into her heart and her head for a little minute here. Here's a little girl. Not even a little boy. Little boys well tend to be full of that little bit more of bravado, and they're scared maybe to cry in front of adults. There's that sense of, masculinity even from their earliest days. But here's a little girl who would have no hesitancy in showing her vulnerableness, her tears, her fear. And she has been literally, as a little girl, stolen out of her home. Away from her family. Listen, she's in a foreign land who speak a foreign tongue. She has a foreign master. Her food is foreign. Everything's unknown to her. She's called a little maid. But the very fact that she was able to serve here, we would expect her at least to have been 8, 9, 10. At least. Maybe slightly older. But either way, she was just a girl. Vulnerable. Scared, I would have no doubt. You imagine the scene that one day with your parents, yes, you know there's a war on, and then all of a sudden the front door bursts in, and these men most likely will have slain the father. And you have seen your father die, and your mother die, and maybe other siblings die, and that same man wielding a sword grabs you by the scruff of your neck and throws you in this chariot and rides off into a foreign country, a foreign land with foreign people, and you know nothing. You would be absolutely petrified as an adult, let alone a little girl, with very little life experience. But here's what I find absolutely remarkable about this little girl. She completely accepts the sovereignty of her God. She just accepts God's sovereignty. This is where I am. My parents have been slaughtered, siblings too, stolen, I've been kidnapped, I'm now a slave. But my God still reigns. And I still trust in my God. And I still respect the God of my father and my mother, because there is absolutely no doubt this girl was brought up in a God-fearing home. Now remember, Israel was full of Baal worship and paganism and all the rest of it, but out of that pagan nation, that's why they were raided and fought against. Out of that pagan nation, here you have a little Daniel. She's like a little young Daniel. And she's come into the foreign land and she burns bright for Jehovah. And so, get this now. She is living in a foreign home and they have a foreign God. How dare she even mention the name of her God? That took bravado. That took bravery. That took courage. There's a little girl. Everything was against her, yet she was brave and bold enough to speak of her God. It would have been no surprise for a little slave to have been at least beaten, if not beheaded, for doing such a thing in your master's house. But not only does she mention the name of her God, she says, listen, you should go to my God. You should go to the servant of Jehovah in Israel, for he can do something. Your God, Naaman, can do nothing. Master, your religion is no good for you. You need my God. So she's ridiculing the God Rimmon. She is teaching her master, and he's a soldier. And she says, go to my God. This little girl genuinely is a diamond in the middle of this whole scene of war and fighting. And is that not so often the case? God's judgment comes. But even in the midst of God's judgment and God's people suffer along with it, but in the middle of all the catastrophe and disaster, you have little diamonds here and there of servants just simply speaking for God, living and accepting God's providence. She doesn't fight with it. She doesn't huff. She doesn't say, you know, well, my God's not great. He's landed me here and I'm a servant. None of that stuff. She accepts God's sovereignty and serves where he has her place. And I have to say, she had a rough ride. She was not placed in a particularly attractive calling in life at all. That's the little maid, the child of faith. Let me move on to show you the conversion of a pagan. Because that's what Naaman really is here. He's a pagan. And I can put it this way. The child that we considered, she accepted God's sovereignty. But this pagan who's about to be converted, to this point, he was completely ignorant of God's sovereignty. He didn't even know there was a God. He didn't know there was a Jehovah. He didn't know that upon the throne of all creation, way above, out of his sight, there is one who sovereignly overlooks everything. And you see, when Naaman woke up one day, or whatever the case was, and he looked at whatever part of his body, his hand, his arm, whatever, and he saw the first white dot, he never dreamt that there was a God in heaven who permitted that leprosy to afflict his body. He never for a moment conceived that the little girl that he happened to be the master of had been brought into his house as a missionary to tell him the gospel. He had no idea of the sovereignty of God in orchestrating all of this for that man's salvation. He was ignorant to it.
But look at him here, verse 1. He was the captain of the host. That little girl was a captive. The complete opposite. Verse 1 goes on to say, now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man. The little girl there in verse 2 is said to be a little maid. Captain, captive. Great man, little maid. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable because of him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. Now just read that. With his master and honorable because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto not Israel but Syria. I want you to get that there. God was fighting against Israel because of their sin. Now you remember that. Just because you're a child of God, do not think that never once will you feel the chastising hand of Jehovah upon you. This land, so-called a Christian country, just because you take the name of a Christian country, do not for a moment think that God will not fight against you. Anyway, that's not what we're looking at this morning. Let's go back to our text. The last two lines there, it says, he was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. And there's the problem. He had a lot going for him. A captain, a great man. By him, God was giving deliverance. God was with him. He was like Jabez. Remember Jabez's prayer? Jabez prayed, oh God, bless me indeed. May the hand of God be with me. May you enlarge my coasts. Lord, keep me from the evil. And it's the evil one is actually the sense of the verse there. Keep me from the evil one. That's exactly what Naaman was enjoying. God was blessing him. God was prospering him. God was literally widening his tent. He was taking over Israel. God was keeping him from the evil one. The devil had nothing against Naaman here because the devil wasn't able to prevent him in doing God's work. Completely ignorant to the sovereignty of God. But here he is, now a leper. And here's what intrigues me. He's going about his house and this little missionary, this little girl, comes and speaks to him about the gospel. And we're told here, we don't need to go through all the details, it's unnecessary here this morning for what we're doing, but he goes to the king and he gets the letter and he arrives in the king of Israel's palace. But look at how the king of Israel responds to Naaman's letter. Verse 7, and it came to pass when the king of Israel had read the letter that he rent his clothes and said, am I God? And so on and so forth. Here's the thing. All the king of Israel could see was the political world. That's all they could see. The king of Israel is every bit as ignorant here of the sovereignty of God as Naaman, this pagan, was. Now, the king of Israel should have known better. He knew of Elisha. He knew about Mount Carmel. He knew there was a God, but all he can see is the political ramifications of this whole scene. He's forgetting that there is a sovereign God upon the throne. And Naaman, in his ignorance, is just kind of drifting along. He's almost like a leaf in the wind. The wind blows and the leaf just, without any will of its own, it just kind of goes along with the wind. That's exactly what Naaman's like here. God is blowing, and he's blowing Naaman right to Elisha's front door. Can you see the sovereignty in this? Here's a captain of the host, a pagan who in many ways is untouchable by any, if you like, prophet or preacher of that day. Who's going to arrive in front of Naaman to give Naaman the gospel? No man. So God sends a little girl. And through that little girl, Naaman comes to the man of God's house. No one is beyond the reach of a sovereign and a mighty God. No one, not even pagan Naaman. But God so sovereignly decreed that Naaman would come to Elisha's house. That should encourage you in your evangelism. For family, for friends, for neighbors, for strangers, for outcasts, for up and outs and down and outs. You pray that God, indeed will be pleased to bring them to your door, to bring them into your way, that you might have the opportunity of leading them to Christ. That's exactly what happened here. And you know, just to finish with Naaman here, you know what happened. He went, he received the word. I need to pause with this for a moment. Naaman received the word of God through Elisha. Let's look at it for a little minute here, because I don't want you to miss this. Verse 10, and Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, go wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. And Naaman was wroth and went away. Why was that? Naaman was puffed up with his own pride. He's not ready to bow down to Jehovah yet. He's a leper. He's a sinner. He's going to die. But even though he's diseased, in many ways he's a disgraced man. For let me tell you, you weren't allowed to come near a leper. You had to be cast out of the city into the leper's village. This man had nothing but absolute despair in front of him. Yet he's still proud. Isn't that the way the sinner is? You are a sinner. You have broken God's law. You've got a disease. And God despises you. And the reality... And let me just say that. I said God despises you. I want to pause there as well. I said this on Wednesday night, and I'll say it again tonight, because it ties into repentance. But we live in a day where there's this ambition to make the gospel as friendly and as sweet as possible so you don't hurt anybody. And so it's said. It's not that God hates the sinner, but God just hates your sin and loves the sinner. Nonsense. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I despised, hated. So my phrase there was biblical language. Do not think that God just hates your sin and loves you. Do not believe that for a moment. That is not true. God hates the sinner. Because if God loved you and hated your sin, he would have to throw your sin into hell and let you into heaven. How would that even work? God will send you to hell because you are the one committing the sin. And that's just like Naaman. He was about to be cast out because of his condition. He was about to be cast out of the city into the city of the lepers and there left to rot and suffer without any help. That's just like hell. Because of your disease of sin, God will cast you out into hell where you're left there to rot and to eternally decay and suffer without any hope of help. Leprosy was a one-way road and there was no escape unless Jehovah cured you. So I just want you to see where this man's at. Yeah, he's still proud. He's still proud. He comes to Elisha's house and he wants a big deal made of him. He wants a bit of razzmatazz here. He wants a wee bit of action, a bit of activity. He wants some glorious scene to happen so he can go back to Syria and he can say, this man came out and there were flashing lights and he waved his hand over me and whatever happened, and all of a sudden the leprosy gone. A great story to tell. But how could he go back to Syria and say, the man told me to go and wash in a dirty river? Doesn't have the same ring about it, doesn't it? Let me tell you, if Facebook was such a thing in that day, he probably wouldn't have put a picture of himself going into the River Jordan for a wash. You wouldn't have done it. You'd have wanted to go somewhere else on a surfboard and a nice scene on a sunny day in the Bahamas. Let me tell you, this was not the scene that Naaman either anticipated nor that he wanted. And I want you to think about that, because maybe you're here this morning unsaved. And in your mind, you anticipate something magnificent happening. You want something glorious, someone to feed your pride, something to make you feel good, something to make you stand out. And people think, wow, look at what that man or that woman or that child went through to get saved. God did something great. That may not be the case. It may simply be a servant. A minister, a neighbor, a friend, a relative, someone, a servant who simply says to you, wash and be clean. No big deal made about you. Just the same as everybody else. You either obey or disobey. You either wash and be clean, or you permit your disease to make you an eternal outcast. This is dead simple. And Naaman didn't like that. But God is sovereign. Because even though Naaman had his mind made up, he was heading back, there were friends there. Obviously friends of Naaman who respected him. And they even said to Naaman here in verse 13, they call him my father, not because they were biologically connected. That was a mark of respect. They said to him in verse 13, and his servants came near and spake unto him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, would thou not have done it? How much more rather when he saith to thee, wash and be clean. God in sovereignty had a group of men there who were there to prompt Naaman in the right way. Naaman was a fool, but God had sent friends to direct this man towards not only being cleansed of his leprosy, but that man was converted. There's no doubt about that. He was converted. Here's how I know he's converted. It's by what he says later. You know, there was some debate over what Naaman says. He was cleansed of the leprosy, and you know all that happened there, so I'll not go over that again. But let me take you here to verse 17. And Naaman said, shall there not then, I pray thee, be given to thy servant two mules? Yeah, I pray thee, be given to thy servant two mules, burden of earth, for thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. He's a believer now. Verse 18, and this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion there. Is this man already, he's just saved, and already he's compromising? And there's lots of debate and lots of discussion here. I don't want to enter into the discussion this morning. Maybe some other time we can do that. But for right now, what I want you to see is this. Here's Naaman. He's a new convert, and straight away, he's struggling with sin. Here's the difference. Going into the house of Rimmon was no problem for him before. All of a sudden, he's wrestling in his mind. Elisha, how do I work with this? I am going back to a pagan land. I am the captain of the host. And when my master leans upon my hand, this was the custom that he would take. I don't know why. Maybe his master was frail or old or his king or whatever. And he had to go in under the captain's guard. And he would lean in the captain's hand. And if the king wanted to bow before Rimmon, naturally, this captain of the guard would have to kneel as well. And Rimmon's thinking here, he's just converted. And already he's thinking not only about worshipping God, but how to live properly in a way that pleases Jehovah. He's changed. That's what I want you to see for now. That's sufficient for this morning. This man has changed. He's wrestling with sin. He's trying to find a way how to live godly in a fallen world. Is it any wonder then Elisha gives this simple response? He just says to him in verse 19, and he said unto him, go in peace. Go in peace. Be assured. I see you're changed. God has worked. You're saved. Now, child of faith, conversion of a pagan. Very quickly here, the last two. I want you to see the contentment of the prophet. You see, here's Elisha here. We don't need to say too much, I suppose, about Elisha, to be honest. But Elisha here, he receives this man, Naaman, and Naaman says, you know, what do you want? You know, you can have whatever you want here, money, clothing, whatever. Elisha says, I don't want anything. Why is that? Well, that little girl accepted God's sovereignty. Naaman was ignorant to God's sovereignty, but Elisha, he simply trusts God's sovereignty. He's going to trust God. I don't need money. I don't need clothes. That's not my concern right now. My only concern is this, Naaman, that you understand the gospel. That you understand that Jehovah is not like your God. Your God, Rimmon. If you're going to get anything from him, you have to give something. My God, Elisha is preaching a sermon here. On other occasions, Elisha did receive things. It's not that it's wrong to receive things, but it depends on the context. Here's a man who worshipped the god Ramon, who was a taker. You had to give and give to your God. I don't know, some of those gods, you had to give your children as a sacrifice. You had to do things to try and appease that God, Ramon, or whoever it was. But Elisha's teaching this man, no, my God is not a taker, he's a receiver. Sorry, my God is not a taker, he's a giver. A giver. He will give you life. He will give you the cure. He will give you what you need, friend. It's true. Our God is not a taker. So unbeliever, don't think here today you have a God who's a hard taskmaster. He says you have to give up this and that and the other thing before you kind of enter into heaven. That's not the way of it. Our God is a giver, a giver. He gave his only son. How could anyone stand at Calvary and even dare say that Jehovah is a taker? He's an absolute perfect giver. You're the taker. We take life, we take blessings, we take finance, we take every heartbeat, and we use it for our own means, to live for our own ends, for our own desires and our own passions, and we forget about God. We take it all and give him nothing. And then at the end of the day, we say that God is hard and difficult, not even allowing me into heaven. You're a fool. Are they blinded to the reality? There is one God, Jehovah. And he will give you life. He gave you his son. Child of faith, accepting sovereignty. Conversion of a pagan who is ignorant to sovereignty. The contentment of a prophet who trusts in sovereignty. Just in closing, I want to show you the corruption of a servant who ignores, not ignorant, but ignores God's sovereignty. You see, here you have Gehazi. And Gehazi was the servant of Elisha. And he was meant to be a servant of God. And he knew from Elisha's teaching that there is a God who controls all things. But Gehazi was a Judas. An Old Testament Judas. The man with the money bag. And he wanted to make sure that he got enough money for whatever reason. I don't know. Maybe he had things he wanted to get. Or I don't know. But he wanted money anyway. He wasn't satisfied. He ignored God's sovereignty. The money wasn't offered to him. In sovereignty, it was Elisha went to the door. And when Naaman came, Naaman offered it to Elisha, not to Gehazi. Prior to this, it was Gehazi went to the door. This time, Elisha goes to the door, Naaman offers him the money, and Gehazi couldn't accept the providence of God here, so he ignores it. And he swears. Look what this man says. You see it there. It's in verse 25, isn't it? And he said, nope, I'm too early. Let me go back here. Well, it's there anyway. He says, by the living God, I will go and get some of these things. Yes, verse 20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, behold, my master have spared Naaman this Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, he's taking God's name. As the Lord lives, so he knows that God lives. But he ignores the sovereignty and he says, I don't care what's happened. As God lives, well, I'm going to go. I'm going to get some of this stuff. I want some of the bounty. I want some reward. For doing what? What does he even want reward for? He did nothing. Nothing. But he wants gain. This man, let me tell you, here's the point I want to make in closing here. He was a man who lived in Israel. He was a man who was surrounded by the covenant family. He was a man who served Elisha. He was Elisha's right-hand man in many ways. There was no excuses. This man, Gehazi, knew the truth, but he didn't want it. And how does this chapter close? The very leprosy that clung to Naaman moved from Naaman and clung on to Gehazi. And you might think, well, boy, that's a bit harsh. He slipped up. No, Gehazi didn't slip up. Gehazi deserved eternal punishment. Because The verse at the end of that chapter says, "It shall cling on to you, Gehazi, and your family forever." Ever. No cure. No hope. He says, "Gehazi, you have committed a great sin." What was the sin that Gehazi committed? Well, there were several. But number one, he gave a false representation of God. That's for sure. Number two, he coveted. Number three, he stole. Number four, he lied. I tell you, Gehazi, in that one action, he proved himself to be an absolute pagan. And so the pagan was converted. Yet the man who was living in Israel with all the privileges surrounded by the people of God turned out to be a pagan. And there's sovereignty there. There's a lesson for you and I, men and women. Just because you're affiliated with a church or a Protestant society or a Christian so-called land means nothing in the judgment day, because God will not be assessing your conditions. He'll be assessing your heart. And God sees your heart. You need saved today. And there's one God who is a giver. He gave his son to die for sinners. Will you continue to be a taker, take what he has given without ever giving to God worship, glory, or repentance? Please come again tonight as we deal with repentance and we deal with salvation. Let's close this morning. 580. Thank you for listening. And I apologize for going over my time again. When our young brother, Aaron Fitzsimons, comes, I will do my very best to keep my sermon short, not to give him bad habits from the very beginning, but we'll see how that goes. 580. 580. A sovereign protector I have. And I wonder, do you have a sovereign protector today? Or are you trusting your flesh? Oh, we have a great God. Trust in him. 580. We'll just sing verse 1.